This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk, and today I have the great pleasure of talking to Lois Banner. She's the author of a book called Marilyn, The Passion and the Paradox. It's a really amazing and powerful biography of Marilyn Monroe. Hi, Lois. How are you?
Hello, David. I'm just fine.
Well, I'm really glad to talk to you about this book, and it's, you know, as we kind of discussed just before we started, it's a long book, and there's, I think, probably a ton of things to talk about. So I'm going to, we probably won't get to everything that either of us is interested in, but, you know, I kind of, let's start off by me asking you, what attracted you so much to writing about Marilyn Monroe?
I love writing biographies of eminent women. I've written biographies of a number of feminist leaders, including Margaret Mead. And I also had written a book on physical appearance, in which I finished by talking about Marilyn. So living in Los Angeles and teaching at one of the major film schools in the nation, the University of Southern California. I'm not in the film school, but I am at that university. It seemed to me a natural to be attracted to Marilyn Monroe, and that's how it started in the beginning.
And, you know, talking about the book, what you've done is basically delve perhaps more deeply into her life than anybody else has. I know you talked about having access to sources that no one else had really used, and you have identified in more detail a lot of things about her youth and her childhood, which, you know, when she, for her, her childhood was hugely important. It was part of her persona. And also, I thought this was really interesting, you talked about the star text, that the kind of the story that was created about her based on her real life, but embellished and codified in a way to suit the publicity needs of the studio and to suit the public persona needs of building a star.
I'm sorry, can I respond?
Absolutely.
Oh yeah, I have the luxury of a university professorship, and that means that I can spend as long as I want on a book. I'm not constrained by the need to make money off a book to support myself. So when I started in working on Marilyn, and working on a book is always a proposition at first of adventure and of trying to figure out what's been written and what you can say, I realized that, in fact, she was conceivably the most complex person that I had ever dealt with. And then I began to realize that I wanted to give her the luxury of as full and complete a biography as I could put together. And you're right, her childhood is very important to what later happened to her. And so I spent a good deal of time tracking down the childhood, the foster homes, the incidents of abuse, et cetera, which became a part of her star text that she wanted people to know about, she wanted people to hear. And so she did weave it into what she had to say about herself. So all of that comes together into what I hope is a powerful narrative.
Well, it is. I think that, you know, I think you've been able to juggle the detail, which you could get lost in sometimes if you didn't have a narrative. And I think that you've kept the narrative going. Actually, I want to talk about the structure of the book too, but I'll save that for a little while. So, I mean, you do take the, you know, you do a kind of traditional biography in the sense of starting at the beginning and ending at the end. So let's talk about her early life. What I thought was really interesting was that that you highlighted the fact that all of the places that she lived, and I think you numbered up to 11 that were called foster homes, you know, we kind of have thought of those almost mythologically as people who, foster parents who are not known to the child before she got there. But in all cases, what she was really part of was a kind of familial network that was built by members of her family or associates of her family. So she actually knew all of the people that she grew up with, all these different families, and she was shuttled from home to home and family to family, but she knew all of them in some way. They were all related to her family in some way, which.
That's correct. They basically were chosen by her guardian, a woman named Grace McKee Goddard. And Grace was a person whom everybody liked, who was happy and joyful most of the time. And so she, when one family didn't work out for a variety of reasons, then she would place Marilyn in a different family that was connected by the links of friendship, mostly family, sometimes friendship. But of course, knowing a family is not the same as living with that family, in which you're going to learn the bad parts of the family as well as the good parts. And like most children, Marilyn did not like being moved. She was unhappy about that. She knew she had a mother. And, well, the father part's a little more complicated because basically her father deserted her very shortly before she was born. And she kind of looked for him for a lot of her life, but she knew she had a mother and she wanted to live in a regular family. So it was always great, very frustrating. And then there were 2 years or a year. The biographers all disagree on this one. And there is evidence to suggest either that she was in the orphanage for a year or for 2 years. And so I tend to think it was a year, but there is evidence suggesting the 2 year part of her stay in the orphanage. She disliked the orphanage very much, although all accounts of the orphanage say it was a very responsible and happy place, but nonetheless, Marilyn did not like being in what she thought was an institution.
And when she was growing up, clearly the you know, being moved from place to place and not having her mother present for most of it, and even when her mother was present, she knew that her mother had been institutionalized with mental illness. It was really, it had, I mean, as you talked about, she developed incredible survival skills, you know, in terms psychologically, whilst going through these, you know, just incredibly complex, changing relationships all the time.
That is true. That is true. In a sense, several things happened to Marilyn in all those families. As might be expected, she became very, very quiet. She was calculating all the time. That's the survival skills of a child. She became very quiet. She didn't talk very much, which made it worse for her in the homes. And also, she became, in a sense, as you said, very wily. She became, in a sense, street smart, because of all the homes she'd been in, learning how to perhaps manipulate people, learning how to somehow keep surviving. And then she was put in different schools a fair amount. I think that her guardian, Grace Goddard, tried to keep her in the same school, but sometimes it was impossible. So she did move schools, and that's very difficult also for a growing child. So we have Marilyn arriving at her pre-adolescent period, 11, 12, when she's a very, very quiet child. She never really says much of anything. She also stutters, which is a problem we can talk about as we go along. She stutters, and she, unfortunately, when she gets to her pre-adolescent years, in the process of growing into adulthood, she reaches that period in pre-adolescence when some children become rather unattractive. And Marilyn was not a beauty. 10 and 11, she was considered to be very plain. She was very tall. She had a very flat body. And she seemed ungainly and awkward. You can see that in photos of her. She's very depressed. Then, of course, what happens when she reaches the age of menstruation is, and then her full, persona, mature body, she suddenly becomes very beautiful, very voluptuous. And then she doesn't grow anymore. She's 5 feet, 6 inches at the age of 10. And then between then, 12, 13, 14, she doesn't grow anymore. So she isn't that doesn't appear that outlandish among the other children. So the story of her childhood is a very complicated story of a young woman growing to maturity in a situation which is very far from being stable and or entirely happy for her. And she, all the rest of her life, because she was teased by the other children for being so tall, she looked like a boy. She never really, really thought she was beautiful.
Well, and also the other thing that you talked about that I thought was important was that, throughout all of the time that she was growing up, she's kind of learning, what she used later. She kind of learns these survival skills. She also suffers tremendously from physical issues that begin to affect her. So these, what you call disabilities, she has mm-hmm. endometriosis, she has painful menstruation. There's all these kind of physical disabilities that she's faced with, incredible challenges. So if you look at, all of the challenges she faced, they were psychological, familial. She was abused at least at some point by one or more men. And she has physical problems throughout her life, so that her ability to survive, thrive, overcome is just unbelievably impressive when you think about all of these challenges that she faced as a person.
Well, I agree. Yeah, the endometriosis, that is connected to the painful menstruation, so that doesn't really happen until she's about 12. But endometriosis, for those who don't know, that's a hormonal condition in which tissue-like growths are produced inside the uterus and not outside, and also outside the uterus in the abdominal cavities. It makes menstruation extremely painful, and it's difficult to diagnose. And in those days, before they knew a lot about hormones, it was very difficult to treat. It's difficult to treat today. Even today, it's fairly difficult to treat. But yes, there was the endometriosis. The other thing was the stuttering, which was very bad when she was a child and then always bothered her, but she did get over it eventually. She had what I would consider to be mild learning disabilities. I think there was some dyslexia, and she never could spell. And people would make fun of her because she had difficulty spelling, but it seems to me that today we would diagnose that as some form of dyslexia or something of that sort, mild, because she read many, many books eventually and seemed to absorb them. And then, of course, there's what is some kind of bipolar ailment. Throughout her life, she suffered from highs and lows. And as I try to make clear in the book, many people of tremendous ability and achievement suffer from bipolarity. Byron, the poet, is maybe an outstanding example of that, as is Emily Dickinson had something on that order, and you find other great artists who suffer from this. So in a sense, when she's really down in the dumps, which can happen, she will take to bed. But it's also easy to forget that the other side of bipolar disorder is the manic side, the highs. And when in the beginning of a high, people can have tremendous creativity. So Marilyn had that, and she did exhibit a lot of creativity when she would move into the manic phase. She had a sort of, I can't call them hallucinations, they're not. She had what we might call a sense of the divine in her. She had a sense of a union with the universe, a kind of radiant spiritual sense, which could come over her from time to time. And these are not unknown states for many people to go into it. And they can be very positive. And I think that at times they were positive for her. So then there's the mental condition, which may or may not have been chemical. We tend to identify these conditions as chemical today. I kind of think in her case there probably was some brain situation that was causing this. But, you know, you can't exactly diagnose it with tests, and they couldn't then, and they can't even really now. So she was caught in the middle of these various disorders, and as she grew older, then they became worse and worse. And she had insomnia. We don't know when it started, but there's indication that it started fairly early in her life. She also saw horrible visions of monsters when she slept. That surprised me when I found that out. But there were so many texts in which she talked about the monsters she saw that looked like witches and demons in 17th century etchings during the witchcraft persecutions. And that made it hard for her to sleep, and it was a very troubling situation to be in. And she refers to it happening in 1956 and 57 when she is in England and married to Arthur Miller. But she does say throughout her life that she will have these terrible, terrible dreams. So she was visited by so many difficulties that she had to take in hand and then had to overcome. And her strong side for many years was in control. I think Marilyn would have been fine. I think she might have developed into a superb actress. But then, of course, she took drugs. From the time she was in early Hollywood, or early in Hollywood, she took drugs, and that was eventually a real problem for her. She took prescription drugs, she took uppers and downers, she took amphetamines, and she took drugs that would depress her and would stop the anxiety that she felt so often, and eventually became addicted. Those were dangerous drugs in those days, and they didn't understand the addictive power. So that, yeah, Marilyn was quite a survivor in ways that I find entirely admirable. And on the other hand, I find them a cautionary tale of how to live a life.
Well, it seems also that, you know, her suffering and loneliness, you know, essentially she had really no kind of nowhere to, like, if you grow up with a family, you've always got someone to turn to, but she continually lost the people that she could have relied on or didn't have them in the first place. So, you know, she must have been deeply alone, and I think it's pretty terrifying.
Well, yes and no. That's an interesting point about Marilyn, in the sense that she said always that she was alone. And her really true friends and support from her family, namely Grace Goddard, she never gave up on Grace, and several of her foster mothers she did remain friends with, but only to her early 20s. At that point, they died. So the family connection was kind of cut off then. But Marilyn, and this is an easy mistake to make about her, because she said, I'm very lonely, I don't have any friends, and it's not true. I mean, the loneliness, maybe. We can be lonely in the middle of a crowd, but she did have a lot of friends. I tracked the friendships very carefully and what people said about her and what she said about others. She was, for example, very friendly with Jane Russell. She was very friendly with Joe DiMaggio's family. She was friendly with Arthur Miller's family. She drew people to her like a magnet. And people loved her particular combination of loneliness and of joy. And one of the things I found that surprised me, and I checked it out again and again, was that she was very funny. She had a natural wit. People loved that. She had many male friends who were not lovers, and they really enjoyed her because she could be the classic pal. She could joke, she could laugh, she made wonderful puns, And those interviews that she's famous for, when she said, you know, what were you wearing in the nude photograph, the famous nude photograph? And she said, the radio. That's one of her wonderful witticisms. She didn't exactly make that one up, but most of the witticisms that she's famous for, she did make up. And she had this natural ability. And a lot of people who've written on her have said that others made those puns up. They did not. She made them up herself. She had that natural gift.
What do you think about all of the, I mean, the relationships that she had with men? I think that this is, you know, some people I think of her as, you know, it's the relationship with Joe DiMaggio. You know, it's kind of, that's the smash musical focus is, you know, the relationships with Joe DiMaggio and Arthur Miller seem to get a lot of attention. But as you document, I mean, she had relationships with an amazingly large number of men, not always sexual, but often it was, I mean, because she was, in a sense, victimized by the patriarchal scene or the patriarchal structure of Hollywood studios, which I thought you talked about really well. That it was was an old men's club, and they treated women as chattel, and the starlets and stars were treated pretty sexually, exploited sexually, pretty much as they possibly could get away with.
The best book on Hollywood that I found during this period is by an anthropologist who was very well known in her own day. Her name is Hortense Powdermaker, and she was an associate at Columbia with Margaret Mead and Ruth Benedict, and she came out to Hollywood in 1950 and interviewed something like 350 people in the film industry. It's called Hollywood, the Dream Factory, and she was the one who introduced me to the misogynist use of women in Hollywood. It's a very in-depth and fascinating look at all levels, and it's then, having read that, the people that I talked to, I finally got to people that I thought were really telling me the truth, and it really, they told me stories that fit right within what Hortense Powdermaker said about Hollywood. She said that the moguls were like the owners on the slave plantations, that they controlled the people completely, that sex was the glue that held Hollywood together, and that the young women were often victimized in Hollywood because, you know, Hollywood was filled with large numbers of beautiful young women all striving to become stars. Not all of them, and I'm pretty careful at documenting how the women could get out of the sexual part of Hollywood, but Marilyn did. Marilyn would do anything to succeed. She had been married. She was fair game. She didn't have anyone sort of powerful behind her. She didn't have a stage mother who was protecting her. She had nothing of that sort. So there she was, and because of the sex abuse in childhood, and this is a tricky point, she didn't sleep with every man she met, but she would sleep with a lot of men. She told Arthur Miller that she thought her body was possessed by men, and if men were attracted to her sexually, then she would sleep with them, she told Nunnally Johnson, as a gift. Now, within the context of the sexual world of Hollywood, such behavior is not unusual, it's not standard, but Marilyn was driven to succeed, and it is a possible outcome of sexual abuse to exhibit behavior that we might call sexual addiction. And I would say that Marilyn had a sex addiction problem or issue, and that she probably was able to deal with it when the marriages were good. Now, the marriage to Joe DiMaggio was never good. The marriage to Arthur Miller worked for a number of years. And to tell you the truth, if there's any great love in her life, it's really not Joe, it's Arthur. She was devastated when divorced from Arthur. In the case of Joe DiMaggio, to my mind, it's a little complicated why she married him in the first place. As Hedda Hopper once said openly in a column, and Hedda's the great Hollywood gossip columnist had once said in a column, they had nothing in common. Why on earth did Marilyn marry Joe? In the end, she wasn't faithful to him. After they married in 1954, in January 1954, and as a result of that, Joe was a very, very domineering Italian man. He wanted his wife to be at home, have children, and be a domestic wife, and she just refused to do that. As a result of her behavior, he beat her. And so the dysfunctionality in their relationship became worse and worse. She divorced him after 9 months of marriage. And then he proceeded, of course, to remain always in love with her and to always be there for her and to try to get her back, which he hadn't succeeded by the time she died, but maybe she was going to give in. It's hard to say from the available material that we have.
Although, you know, one thing I wrote down that you quoted her as saying that I just thought was really evocative, and that is she said she had to remember that her body was her own, that no one else possessed it.
That's correct.
I thought mm-hmm. that was really powerful, that it was something that obviously she was very smart and she was aware of who she was in this system, mm-hmm. of what she was doing, even mm-hmm. when she was doing things that maybe she, you know, realized were mm-hmm. not in her own best interests. I want to talk about the story you tell about how she died, because I thought, you know, you went into that in a really interesting way.
Well, yeah, that's a hard one. But first I want to say that because of the sexual abuse, and this, again, is characteristic of victims of sexual abuse, she probably dissociated. In other words, her personality probably split into elements, and she both had control over those elements and didn't have control over those elements. So that all her life she was struggling with urges and impulses that she couldn't completely control. And that particular statement about wanting to have total control over her body, I think that she wrote that down one night. Marilyn used to write a lot of things down at night, and fragments, little fragments, she would write down to tell herself things she should do. I think that was something that she was probably working on in her therapy. She was in Freudian therapy for many years, and I think she was working on that in her therapy. And I think it's just a plaintive, sad remark she made.
Well, it is very sad.
Oh, and then the circumstances of her death.
Yeah, I thought, you know, you were, you know, it's her death is so much more complicated than I think I had realized previously. So maybe you could talk a little bit about some of the complexities there. I mean, there's the involvement. She was so many people that she was involved with at that point. She'd had an affair with John F. Kennedy. She then was cut off from him by the White House. Then she had some kind of a relationship with Bobby Kennedy. She was connected to Giancana and the Mafia through Sinatra and Sammy Davis and all these other people. I mean, it's just incredibly sad and terrible to realize that it's possible that she was murdered.
Yeah, she had an amazing ability to make her life more complicated than one could possibly imagine. That's because she had such energy and drew so many people to her, was constantly looking for a place she felt safe. Those people that she was involved with after the divorce from DiMaggio, which occurred approximately a year and a half before she died, I mean the divorce from Miller, I'm sorry, those people weren't good for her, and she should have known better, but she didn't, because they were very glamorous, even to her, you know, the whole Frank Sinatra and Sam Giancana crowd. Now, one thing we have to realize, which is a little complicated that I was so surprised to find out, is that Joe DiMaggio knew all those mafia figures too. And that he spent time with them, and at points they gave him money because he was Italian too, and he would greet at their clubs. They controlled the entire entertainment industry in terms of nightclubs, and he would be a greeter at their clubs. So he knew them also. So those people were very dangerous, and Marilyn kind of knew they were dangerous. So it's really perplexing that she would become involved with them in any way whatsoever. And it's also hard to tell if the involvement was very powerful or if it was peripheral to her life. But she had. And she was traveling in very dangerous waters. Marilyn had a tendency to get herself involved in complicated and a little bit dangerous situations. One of her friends said that she lived her life like a spy story. And another said she would have loved to have been a lady private eye. And so that was going on before the circumstances surrounding her death occurred. And then we get into even more complexities, because we know through FBI records that she had gone to Mexico City in February before she died. And in Mexico City, she had visited several members of the what's called the Hollywood 20. There was the Hollywood 10, a lot of whom went to Mexico, who had been accused and then convicted of communist leanings by the McCarthy Committee and the other committees in the Congress. And she had gone down there and met these people. And the FBI had an informant in those meetings, and so we know the conversations that went on. And one of the people who was there, who was a member of the Hollywood 20, Frederick Vanderbilt Field, he actually, in his memoir, also wrote down the conversations that went on when she visited him and his wife in Mexico City. And she had become very radical by then in her political views. She was pro-Castro. She felt Castro had really helped the Cuban people. And she was at base, always identified with her working class background, and always for what she called the people. She wanted equality. And equality meant to her economic equality, and it meant legal equality. And she was, in this time of great turmoil over civil rights, and over conditions of poverty in the nation, she said, we just have to have equality. And so Castro seemed to her to have done that, since he had thrown out the mob in Havana. And she was talking to the Hollywood people that she met in Mexico in this vein. And she'd also been very critical of the Kennedys and of their stand on Castro. And she was at that point critical of their stand on civil rights. And she had spoken to Bobby directly about it. And that was dangerous, too, because she'd been followed by the FBI for years. And I think the poor woman, no wonder she got paranoid and a little bit crazy in 1962, because she was being followed by the FBI, and DiMaggio always had someone following her because he wanted to know what she was doing. And, then she got embroiled in big arguments with her studio, 20th Century Fox. So the summer of 62, before her death in August, she was operating on many levels and in many territories. And it all is sort of is a lead up to the eventual circumstances of her death.
Well, I will save, I'll let people read it for themselves, but I just wanted to ask, do you feel, after reading through all of this material and thinking about what happened, do you feel that it's really possible that she was murdered as opposed to either committing suicide or accidentally overdosing on drugs? What do you think happened?
I don't quite see how she was able to overdose during that 24-hour period before her death. I guess it's conceivable. It all gets into these complexities about, was she taking drugs or wasn't she taking drugs, and how did the drugs interact with her system? And that is, there's a lot of controversy over that. But it's conceivable that she overdosed. It's conceivable that she committed suicide. I don't think so, though, because we have conversations she had with friends the night that she died, which make it doesn't sound as though she was contemplating suicide in those conversations. So the best possibility is that she accidentally overdosed, but there's a very good possibility that she was murdered. A lot of people were very unhappy with some of the things she was doing. And the Kennedys were unhappy. There was a cover-up to conceal her relationship with the Kennedys. Police records were destroyed. Records at her autopsy were destroyed. The decision to make it officially a suicide was a set-up deal. You know, but that doesn't mean the Kennedys killed her. The cover-up's pretty clear, but they may have, they may not have.
Right, it could have.
We can trace Bobby Kennedy to her house, but it's hard to trace him to the actual scene that night.
Right, and there are plenty of other possibilities for...
There are many other possibilities, yes.
Yeah, so it's an amazing story. I think it's just, you know, an incredible life, and, I think still we feel the tragedy of her death today, because you feel like, had she lived, she would have become something much more... She would have transformed herself even further. I mean, her life was a series of transformations, and it's likely that if she had lived, she would have transformed herself again more, maybe multiple times.
Yeah, we hope so. The possibility is always there that she might have. She was a great actress. She was a very smart person, very intellectual, read books all the time, and had huge potential. She achieved huge successes, and you're right, transformed herself on a number of periods in her life. She transformed herself.
Well, it is a wonderful book, and I love talking to you about it, because I think there's so much to talk about, and I want to thank you for spending the time. This has been David Wilk with Lois Banner talking about her biography of Marilyn Monroe, Marilyn, The Passion and the Paradox. It's a book I highly recommend.